and stood back to wait in the eerie silence, tracing the shape of Miss Peregrine's letter in my pocket. I'd taken it along in case I needed to prove who I was, but as a minute ticked by, then two, it seemed less and less likely that I would need it. Climbing down into the yard, I circled the house looking for another way in, taking the measure of the place, but it seemed almost without measure, as though with every corner I turned, the house sprouted new balconies and turrets and chimneys. Then I came around back and saw my opportunity, a doorless doorway, bearded with vines, gaping and black, an open mouth just waiting to swallow me. Just looking at it made my skin crawl. But I hadn't come halfway around the world just to run away screaming at the sight of a scary house. I thought of all the horrors Grandpa Portman had faced in his life, and felt my resolve harden. If there was anyone to find inside, I would find them. I mounted the crumbling steps and crossed the threshold. Standing in a tomb-dark hallway just inside the door, I stared frozenly at what looked for all the world like skins hanging from hooks. After a queasy moment in which I imagined some twisted cannibal leaping from the shadows with knife in hand, I realized they were only coats rotted to rags and green with age. I shuddered involuntarily and took a deep breath. I'd only explored 10 feet of the house and was already about to foul my underwear. "Keep it together," I told myself, and then slowly moved forward, heart hammering in my chest. Each room was a disaster more incredible than the last. Newspapers gathered in drifts, scattered toys, evidence of children long gone lay skinned in dust. Creeping mold had turned window-adjacent walls black and furry. Fireplaces were throttled with vines that had descended from the roof and begun to spread across the floors like alien tentacles. The kitchen was a science experiment gone terribly wrong. Entire shelves of jarred food had exploded from 60 seasons of freezing and thawing, splattering the wall with evil-looking stains, and fallen plaster lay so thickly over the dining room floor that for a moment I thought it had snowed indoors. At the end of a light-starved corridor, I tested my weight on a rickety staircase, my boots leaving fresh tracks and layers of dust. The steps groaned as if woken from a long sleep. If anyone was upstairs, they'd been there a very long time. Finally, I came upon a pair of rooms missing entire walls, into which a little forest of underbrush and stunted trees had grown. I stood in the sudden breeze wondering what could possibly have done that kind of damage, and began to get the feeling that something terrible had happened here. I couldn't square my grandfather's idyllic stories with this nightmare house, nor the idea that he'd found refuge here with the sense of disaster that pervaded it. There was more left to explore, but suddenly it seemed like a waste of time. It was impossible that anyone could still be living here, even the most misanthropic recluse. I left the house feeling like I was further than ever from the truth. Chapter 4. Once I'd hopped and tripped and felt my way like a blind man through the woods in fog and re-emerged into the world of sun and light, I was surprised to find the sun sinking and the light going red. Somehow the whole day had slipped away. At the pub, my dad was waiting for me, a black-as-night beer and his open laptop on the table in front of him. I sat down and swiped his beer before he'd had a chance to even look up from typing. "Oh, my sweet Lord," I sputtered, choking down a mouthful. "What is this, fermented motor oil?" "Just about," he said, laughing, and then snatched it back. "It's not like American beer. Not that you'd know what that tastes like, right?" "Absolutely not," I said with a wink, even though it was true. My dad liked to believe I was as popular and adventuresome as he was at my age, a myth it had always seemed easiest to perpetuate. I underwent a brief interrogation about how I'd gotten to the house and who'd taken me there, and because the easiest kind of lying is when you leave things out of the story rather than make them up, I passed with flying colors. I conveniently forgot to mention that Worm and Dylan had tricked me into wading through sheep excrement and then bailed out a half mile from our destination. Dad seemed pleased that I'd already managed to meet a couple kids my own age. I guess I also forgot to mention the part about them hating me. "So how was the house?"
"Trashed."
He winced. "Guess it's been a long time since your grandpa lived there, huh?"
"Yeah, or anyone."
He closed the laptop, a sure sign I was about to receive his full attention.
"I can see you're disappointed."
"Well, I didn't come thousands of miles looking for a house full of creepy garbage."
"So what are you going to do?"
"Find people to talk to. Someone will know what happened to the kids who used to live there. I figure a few of them must still be alive, on the mainland if not around here, in a nursing home or something."
"Sure, that's an idea."
He didn't sound convinced, though. There was an odd pause, and then he said,
"So do you feel like you're starting to get a better handle on who your grandpa was, being here?"
I thought about it. "I don't know. I guess so. It's just an island, you know?"
He nodded.
"Exactly. What about you?"
"Me?"
He shrugged. "I gave up trying to understand my father a long time ago."
"That's sad. Weren't you interested?"
"Sure I was. Then, after a while, I wasn't anymore." I could feel the conversation going in a direction I wasn't entirely comfortable with, but I persisted anyway.
"Why not?"
"When someone won't let you in, eventually you stop knocking. Know what I mean?" He hardly ever talked like this. Maybe it was the beer, or that we were so far from home, or maybe he decided I was finally old enough to hear this stuff. Whatever the reason, I didn't want him to stop.
"But he was your dad. How could you just give up?"
"It wasn't me who gave up," he said a little too loudly, then looked down, embarrassed, and swirled the beer in his glass.
"It's just that,
the truth is, I think your grandpa didn't know how to be a dad, but he felt like he had to be one anyway, because none of his brothers or sisters survived the war. So he dealt with it by being gone all the time, on hunting trips, business trips, you name it. And even when he was around, it was like he wasn't."
"Is this about that one Halloween?"
"What are you talking about?"
"You know, from the picture."
It was an old story, and it went like this. It was Halloween, my dad was 4 or 5 years old, and had never been trick-or-treating, and Grandpa Portman had promised to take him when he got off work. My grandmother had bought my dad this ridiculous pink bunny costume, and he put it on and sat by the driveway waiting for Grandpa Portman to come home from 5 o'clock until nightfall, but he never did. Grandma was so mad that she took a picture of my dad crying in the street just so she could show my grandfather what a huge asshole he was. Needless to say, that picture has long been an object of legend among members of my family, and a great embarrassment to my father.
"It was a lot more than just one Halloween," he grumbled.
"Really, Jake, you were closer to him than I ever was. I don't know. There was just something unspoken between the two of you." I didn't know how to respond. Was he jealous of me?
"Why are you telling me this?"
"Because you're my son, and I don't want you to get hurt."
"Hurt how?"
He paused. Outside, the clouds shifted, the last rays of daylight throwing our shadows against the wall. I got a sick feeling in my stomach, like when your parents are about to tell you they're splitting up, but you know it before they even open their mouths.
"I never dug too deep with your grandpa because I was afraid of what I'd find," he said finally.
"You mean about the war?"
"No. Your grandpa kept those secrets because they were painful. I understood that. I mean about the traveling, him being gone all the time. What he was really doing. I think, your aunt and I both thought, that there was another woman. Maybe more than one."
I let it hang between us for a moment. My face tingled strangely.
"That's crazy, Dad."
"We found a letter once.
It was from a woman whose name we didn't know, addressed to your grandfather. I love you. I miss you. When are you coming back? That kind of thing. Seedy, lipstick on the collar type stuff. I'll never forget it. I felt a hot stab of shame, like somehow it was my own crime he was describing, and yet I couldn't quite believe it. We tore up the letter and flushed it down the toilet. Never found another one either. Guess he was more careful after that. I didn't know what to say. I couldn't look at my father. I'm sorry, Jake. This must be hard to hear. I know how much you worshipped him. He reached out to squeeze my shoulder, but I shrugged him off, then scraped back my chair and stood up. I don't worship anyone. Okay, I didn't want you to be surprised, that's all. I grabbed my jacket and slung it over my shoulder. What are you doing? Dinner's on the way. You're wrong about him, I said, and I'm going to prove it. He sighed. It was a letting go kind of sigh. Okay, I hope you do. I slammed out of the priest hole and started walking, heading nowhere in particular. Sometimes you just need to go through a door. It was true, of course, what my dad had said. I did worship my grandfather. There were things about him that I needed to be true, and his being an adulterer was not one of them. When I was a kid, Grandpa Portman's fantastic stories meant it was possible to live a magical life. Even after I stopped believing them, there was still something magical about my grandfather. To have endured all the horrors he did, to have seen the worst of humanity and have your life made unrecognizable by it, to come out of all that the honorable and good and brave person I knew him to be, that was magical. So I couldn't believe he was a liar and a cheater and a bad father, because if Grandpa Portman wasn't honorable and good, I wasn't sure anyone could be. The museum's doors were open, and its lights were on, but no one seemed to be inside. I'd gone there to find the curator, hoping he knew a thing or two about the island's history and people, and could shed some light on the empty house and the whereabouts of its former inhabitants. Figuring he'd just stepped out for a minute, the crowds weren't exactly kicking down his door, I wandered into the sanctuary to kill time checking out museum displays. The exhibits, such as they were arranged in big open-fronted cabinets that lined the walls and stood where pews had once been. For the most part, they were unspeakably boring, all about life in a traditional fishing village and the enduring mysteries of animal husbandry, but one exhibit stood out from the rest. It was in a place of honor at the front of the room, in a fancy case that rested atop what had been the altar. It lived behind a rope I stepped over, and a little warning sign I didn't bother to read, and its case had polished wooden sides and a plexiglass top so that you could only see into it from above. When I looked inside, I think I actually gasped, and for one panicky second thought, "Monster!" because I had suddenly and unexpectedly come face to face with a blackened corpse. Its shrunken body bore an uncanny resemblance to the creatures that had haunted my dreams, as did the color of its flesh, which was like something that had been spit-roasted over a flame. But when the body failed to come alive and scar my mind forever by breaking the glass and going for my jugular, my initial panic subsided. It was just a museum display, albeit an excessively morbid one. "I see you've met the old man," called a voice from behind me, and I turned to see the curator striding in my direction. "You handled it pretty well. I've seen grown men faint dead away." He grinned and reached out to shake my hand. "Martin Paget, don't believe I caught your name the other day." "Jacob Portman," I said. "Who's this, Wales' most famous murder victim?" "Ha! Well, he might be that too, though I never thought of him that way. He's our island's senior most resident, better known in archaeological circles as Cairnholm Man, though to us, he's just the old man. More than 2,700 years old, to be exact, though he was only 16 when he died. So he's rather a young old man, really. 2700? I said, glancing at the dead boy's face, his delicate features somehow perfectly preserved. But he looks so...
That's what happens when you spend your golden years in a place where oxygen and bacteria can't exist, like the underside of our bog. It's a regular fountain of youth down there, provided you're already dead, that is.
That's where you found him, the bog?
He laughed. Not me. Turf cutters did, digging for peat by the big stone cairn out there, back in the 70s.
He looked so fresh, they thought there might be a killer loose on Cairnholm,
till the cops had a look at the Stone Age bow in his hand and the noose of human hair around his neck. They don't make 'em like that anymore.
I shuddered. Sounds like a human sacrifice or something.
Exactly. He was done in by a combination of strangulation, drowning, disembowelment, and a blow to the head.
Seems rather like overkill, don't you think?
I guess so.
Martin roared with laughter.
He guesses so.
Okay, yeah, it does.
Sure it does. But the really fascinating thing, to us modern folk anyway, is that in all likelihood the boy went to his death willingly, eagerly even. His people believe that bogs, and our bog in particular, were entrances to the world of the gods, and so the perfect place to offer up their most precious gift, themselves.
That's insane.
I suppose, though I imagine we're killing ourselves right now in all manner of ways that'll seem insane to people in the future. And as doors to the next world go, a bog ain't a bad choice. It's not quite water, and it's not quite land. It's an in-between place.
He bent over the case, studying the figure inside.
Ain't he beautiful?
I looked at the body again, throttled and flayed and drowned, and somehow made immortal in the process.
I don't think so, I said.
Martin straightened, then began to speak in a grandiose tone.
Come you, and gaze upon the tar man. Blackly he reposes. Tender face the color of soot, withered limbs like veins of coal, feet lumps of driftwood hung with shriveled grapes.
He threw his arms out like a hammy stage actor and began to strut around the case.
Come, you, and bear witness to the cruel art of his wounds, pearled and meandering lines drawn by knives, brain and bone exposed by stones, the rope still digging at his throat. First fruit slashed and dumped, seeker of heaven, old man arrested in youth, I almost love you.
He took a theatrical bow as I applauded.
Wow, I said, did you write that? Guilty, he replied with a sheepish smile. I twiddle about with lines of verse now and then, but it's only a hobby. In any case, thank you for indulging me.
I wondered what this odd, well-spoken man was doing on Cairnholm, with his pleated slacks and half-baked poems, looking more like a bank manager than someone who lived on a windswept island with one phone and no paved roads.
Now, I'd be happy to show you the rest of my collection, he said, escorting me toward the door, but I'm afraid it's shutting up time. If you'd like to come back tomorrow, however...
Actually, I was hoping you might know something, I said, stopping him before he could shoo me out. It's about the house I mentioned this morning. I went to see it.
Well, he exclaimed, I thought I'd scared you off it. How's our haunted mansion faring these days? Still standing?
I assured him that it was, then got right to the point. The people that live there... Do you have any idea what happened to them?
They're dead, he replied. Happened a long time ago.
I was surprised, though I probably shouldn't have been. Miss Peregrine was old. Old people die, but that didn't mean my search was over.
I'm looking for anyone else who might have lived there too, not just the headmistress.
All dead, he repeated. No one's lived there since the war.
That took me a moment to process. What do you mean? What war?
When we say the war, around here, my boy, there's only one that we mean. The second. It was a German air raid that got him, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that can't be right.
He nodded. In those days, there was an anti-aircraft gun battery at the far tip of the island, past the wood where the house is. It made Cairnholm a legitimate military target. Not that legitimate mattered much to the Germans, one way or another, mind you. Anyway, one of the bombs went off track, and, well, he shook his head. Nasty luck.
That can't be right, I said again, though I was starting to wonder.
Why don't you sit down and let me fix you some tea? He said. You look a bit off the mark.
Just feeling a little lightheaded. He led me to a chair in his office and went to make the tea. I tried to collect my thoughts. Bombed in the war. That would certainly explain those rooms with blown-out walls. But what about the letter from Miss Peregrine? Postmarked Cairnholm. Sent just 15 years ago. Martin returned, handing me a mug.
There's a nip of Penderin in it, he said. Secret recipe, you know. Should get you sorted in no time.
I thanked him and took a sip, realizing too late that the secret ingredient was high-test whiskey. It felt like napalm flushing down my esophagus.
It does have a certain kick, I admitted, my face going red.
He frowned.
Reckon I ought to fetch your father.
No, no, I'll be fine. But if there's anything else you can tell me about the attack, I'd be grateful.
Martin settled into a chair opposite me. About that, I'm curious. You say your grandfather lived here. He never mentioned it?
I'm curious about that, too, I said. I guess it must have been after his time. Did it happen late in the war or early?
I'm ashamed to admit I don't know. But if you're keen, I can introduce you to someone who does. My Uncle Augie. He's 83. Lived here his whole life. Still sharp as a tack.
Martin glanced at his watch.
If we catch him before Father Ted comes on the telly, I'm sure he'd be more than happy to tell you anything you like.
10 minutes later, Martin and I were wedged deep in an overstuffed sofa in Augie's living room, which was piled high with books and boxes of worn-out shoes and enough lamps to light up Carlsbad caverns, all but one of them unplugged. Living on a remote island, I was starting to realize, turned people into pack rats. Augie sat facing us in a threadbare blazer and pajama bottoms, as if he'd been expecting company, just not pants-worthy company, and rocked endlessly in a plastic-covered easy chair as he talked. He seemed happy to have an audience, and after he'd gone on at length about the weather and Welsh politics and the sorry state of today's youth, Martin was finally able to steer him around to the attack and the children from the home.
Sure, I remember them, he said. Odd collection of people. We'd see them in town now and again, the children. Sometimes they're minder women, too, buying milk and medicine and what have you. You'd say, good morning, and they'd look the other way. Kept to themselves, they did, off in that big house. Lot of talk about what might have been going on over there, though no one knew for sure.
What kind of talk?
Lot of rot. Like I said, no one knew. All I can say is they weren't your regular sort of orphan children. Not like them Bernardo home kids they got in other places, who you'll see come into town for parades and things, and always have time for a chat. This lot was different. Some of 'em couldn't even speak the King's English, or any English for that matter.
Because they weren't really orphans, I said. They were refugees from other countries, Poland, Austria, Czechoslovakia.
Is that what they were now?
Augie said, cocking an eyebrow at me.
Funny, I hadn't heard that.
He seemed offended, like I'd insulted him by pretending to know more about his island than he did. His chair rocking got faster, more aggressive. If this was the kind of reception my grandpa and the other kids got on Cairnholm, I thought, no wonder they kept to themselves. Martin cleared his throat. So, Uncle, the bombing.
Oh, keep your hair on. Yes, yes, the goddamn cherries. Who could forget them?
He launched into a long-winded description of what life on the island was like under threat of German air raids. The blaring sirens, the panicked scrambles for shelter, the volunteer air raid warden who ran from house to house at night, making sure shades had been drawn and streetlights were put out to rob enemy pilots of easy targets. They prepared as best they could, but never really thought they'd get hit, given all the ports and factories on the mainland, all much more important targets than Cairnholm's little gun emplacement. But one night, the bombs began to fall.
The noise was dreadful, Augie said. It was like giants stamping across the island, and it seemed to go on for ages. They gave us a hell of a pounding, though no one in town was killed, thank heaven. Can't say the same for our gunner boys, though they gave as good as they got, nor the poor souls at the orphan home. One bomb was all it took. Gave up their lives for Britain, they did. So wherever they was from, God bless 'em for that.
Do you remember when it happened? I asked. Early in the war or late?
I can tell you the exact day, he said. It was the 3rd of September, 1940.
The air seemed to go out of the room. I flashed to my grandfather's ashen face, his lips just barely moving, uttering those very words. September 3rd, 1940. Are you sure about that? That it was that day?
I never got to fight, he said. Too young by a year. That one night was my whole war. So yes, I'm sure.
I felt numb, disconnected. It was too strange. Was someone playing a joke on me, I wondered? A weird, unfunny joke?
And there weren't any survivors at all? Martin asked.
The old man thought for a moment, his gaze drifting up to the ceiling.
Now that you mention it, he said, I reckon there were just one, a young man, not much older than this boy here.
His rocking stopped as he remembered it.
Walked into town the morning after with not a scratch upon him. Hardly seemed perturbed at all, considering he'd just seen all his mates go to their reward. It was the queerest thing.
He was probably in shock, Martin said.
I shouldn't wonder, replied Augie. He spoke only once, to ask my father when the next boat was leaving for the mainland. Said he wanted to take up arms directly and kill the damned monsters who murdered his people.
Augie's story was nearly as far-fetched as the ones Grandpa Portman used to tell, and yet I had no reason to doubt him. I knew him, I said. He was my grandfather. They looked at me, astonished.
Well, Augie said, I'll be blessed.
I excused myself and stood up. Martin, remarking that I seemed out of sorts, offered to walk me back to the pub, but I declined. I needed to be alone with my thoughts. Come and see me soon, then, he said, and I promised I would. I took the long way back, past the swaying lights of the harbor, the air heavy with brine and with chimney smoke from 100 hearth fires. I walked to the end of a dock and watched the moon rise over the water, imagining my grandfather standing there on that awful morning after, numb with shock, waiting for a boat that would take him away from all the death he'd endured, to war, and more death. There was no escaping the monsters, not even on this island, no bigger on a map than a grain of sand, protected by mountains of fog and sharp rocks and seething tides, not anywhere. That was the awful truth my grandfather had tried to protect me from. In the distance, I heard the generator sputter and spin down, and all the lights along the harbor and in the house windows behind me surged for a moment before going dark. I imagined how such a thing might look from an airplane's height, the whole island suddenly winking out as if it had never been there at all. A supernova in miniature. I walked back by moonlight, feeling small. I found my dad in the pub at the same table where he'd been, a half-eaten plate of beef and gravy congealing into grease before him.
"Look who's back," he said as I sat down. "I saved your dinner for you."
"I'm not hungry," I said, and told him what I'd learned about Grandpa Portman. He seemed more angry than surprised.
"I can't believe he never brought this up," he said. "Not one time."
I could understand his anger. It was one thing for a grandparent to withhold something like that from a grandchild, quite another for a father to keep it from his son, and for so long. I tried to steer the conversation in a more positive direction. "It's amazing, isn't it? Everything he went through?" My father nodded.
"I don't think we'll ever know the full extent of it."
Grandpa Portman really knew how to keep a secret, didn't he?
"Are you kidding? The man was an emotional Fort Knox."
"I wonder if it doesn't explain something, though. Why he acted so distant when you were little." Dad gave me a sharp look, and I knew I needed to make my point quickly or risk overstepping. He'd already lost his family twice before, once in Poland and then again here, his adopted family. So when you and Aunt Susie came along...
"Once bombed, twice shy?"
"I'm serious. Don't you think this can mean that maybe he wasn't cheating on Grandma after all?"
"I don't know, Jake. I guess they don't believe things are ever that simple."
He let out a sigh, breath fogging the inside of his beer glass.
"I think I know what all this really explains, though. Why you and Grandpa were so close."
"Okay?"
"It took him 50 years to get over his fear of having a family. You came along at just the right time."
I didn't know how to respond. How do you say, "I'm sorry your father didn't love you enough," to your own dad? I couldn't. So instead, I just said goodnight and headed upstairs to bed. I tossed and turned most of the night. I couldn't stop thinking about the letters. The one my dad and Aunt Susie had found as kids, from this other woman, and the one I'd found a month ago from Miss Peregrine. The thought that kept me awake was this: what if they were the same woman? The postmark on Miss Peregrine's letter was 15 years old, but by all accounts, she'd been blown into the stratosphere back in 1940. To my mind, that left two possible explanations. Either my grandfather had been corresponding with a dead person, admittedly unlikely, or the person who wrote the letter was not, in fact, Miss Peregrine, but someone who was using her identity to disguise her own. Why would you disguise your identity in a letter? Because you have something to hide, because you are the other woman. What if the only thing I had discovered on this trip was that my grandfather was an adulterous liar? In his last breaths, was he trying to tell me about the death of his adopted family? Or admit to some tawdry, decades-long affair? Maybe it was both. And the truth was that by the time he was a young man, he'd had his family torn apart so many times, he no longer knew how to have one, or to be faithful to one. It was all just guesswork, though. I didn't know, and there was no one to ask. Anyone who might have had the answer was long dead. In less than 24 hours, the whole trip had become pointless. I fell into an uneasy sleep. At dawn, I woke to the sound of something in my room. Rolling over to see what it was, I bolted upright in bed. A large bird was perched on my dresser, staring me down. It had a sleek head feathered in gray and talons that clacked on the wooden dresser as it sidled back and forth along the edge, as if to get a better look at me. I stared back rigidly, wondering if this could be a dream. I called out for my dad, and at the sound of my voice, the bird launched itself off the dresser. I threw my arm across my face and rolled away. And when I peeked again, it was gone, flown out the open window. My dad stumbled in, bleary-eyed.
"What's going on?"
I showed him the talon marks on the dresser and a feather that had landed on the floor.
"God, that's weird," he said, turning it over in his hands. "Peregrines almost never come this close to humans."
I thought maybe I'd heard him wrong. "Did you say peregrines?" He held up the feather.
"A peregrine falcon," he said. "They're amazing creatures, the fastest birds on Earth. They're like shapeshifters, the way they streamline their bodies in the air."
The name was just a weird coincidence, but it left me with an uncanny feeling I couldn't shake. Over breakfast, I began to wonder if I'd given up too easily. Though it was true there was no one left alive whom I could talk to about my grandfather, there was still the house, a lot of it unexplored. If it had ever held answers about my grandfather, in the form of letters maybe, or a photo album or a diary, they'd probably burned up or rotted away decades ago. But if I left the island without making sure, I knew I'd regret it. And that is how someone who is unusually susceptible to nightmares, night terrors, the creeps, the willies, and seeing things that aren't really there, talks himself into making one last trip to the abandoned, almost certainly haunted house where a dozen or more children met their untimely end. Chapter 5. It was an almost too perfect morning. Leaving the pub felt like stepping into one of those heavily retouched photos that come loaded as wallpaper on new computers. Streets of artfully decrepit cottages stretched into the distance, giving way to green fields sewn together by meandering rock walls, the whole scene topped by scudding white clouds. But beyond all that, above the houses and fields and sheep doddering around like little puffs of cotton candy, I could see tongues of dense fog licking over the ridge in the distance, where this world ended and the next one began, cold, damp, and sunless. I walked over the ridge and straight into a rain shower. True to form, I had forgotten my rubber boots, and the path was a rapidly deepening ribbon of mud. But getting a little wet seemed vastly preferable to climbing that hill twice in one morning, so I bent my head against the spitting rain and trudged onward. Soon I passed the shack, dim outlines of sheep huddled inside against the chill, and then the mist-shrouded bog, silent and ghostly. I thought about the 2,700-year-old resident of Cairnholm's museum and wondered how many more like him these fields held, undiscovered, arrested in death. How many more had given up their lives here, looking for heaven? By the time I reached the children's home, what had begun as a drizzle was a full-on downpour. There was no time to dally in the house's feral yard and reflect upon its malevolent shape, the way the doorless doorway seemed to swallow me as I dove through it, the way the hall's rain-bloated floorboards gave a little beneath my shoes. I stood wringing water from my shirt and shaking out my hair, and when I was as dry as I was going to get, which was not very, I began to search. For what? I wasn't sure. A box of letters? My grandfather's name scribbled on a wall? It all seemed so unlikely. I roved around, peeling up mats of old newspaper and looking under chairs and tables. I imagined uncovering some horrible scene, a tangle of skeletons dressed in fire-blackened rags, but all I found were rooms that had become more outside than inside, character stripped away by moisture and wind and layers of dirt. The ground floor was hopeless. I went back to the staircase, knowing this time I would have to climb it. The only question was, up or down? One strike against going upstairs was its limited options for quick escape, from squatters or ghouls or whatever else my anxious mind could invent, other than hurling myself from an upper-story window. Downstairs had the same problem, and with the added detractor of being dark, and me without a flashlight. So upstairs, it was. The steps protested my weight with a symphony of shudders and creaks, but they held. And what I discovered upstairs, compared to the bombed-out ground floor at least, was like a time capsule. Arranged along a hallway, striped with peeling wallpaper, the rooms were in surprisingly good shape, though one or two had been invaded by mold where a broken window had let in the rain. The rest were packed with things that seemed only a layer or two of dust away from new. A mildewed shirt tossed casually over the back of a chair, loose change skimming a nightstand. It was easy to believe that everything was just as the children had left it, as if time had stopped the night they died. I went from room to room, examining their contents like an archaeologist. There were wooden toys moldering in a box, crayons on a windowsill, their colors dulled by the light of 10,000 afternoons, a dollhouse with dolls inside, lifers in an ornate prison. In a modest library, the creep of moisture had bowed the shelves into crooked smiles. I ran my finger along the balding spines, as if considering pulling one out to read. There were classics like Peter Pan and The Secret Garden, histories written by authors forgotten by history, textbooks of Latin and Greek. In the corner were corralled a few old desks. This had been their classroom, I realized, and Miss Peregrine, their teacher. I tried to open a pair of heavy doors, twisting the handle, but they were swelled shut, so I took a running start and rammed them with my shoulder. They flew open with a rasping shriek, and I fell face first into the next room. As I picked myself up and looked around, I realized that it could only have belonged to Miss Peregrine. It was like a room in Sleeping Beauty's castle, with cobwebbed candles mounted in wall sconces, a mirrored vanity table topped with crystal bottles, and a giant oak bed. I pictured the last time she'd been here, scrambling out from under the sheets in the middle of the night to the whine of an air raid siren, rounding up the children, all groggy and grasping for coats on their way downstairs. "Were you scared?" I wondered. "Did you hear the planes coming?" I began to feel unusual. I imagined I was being watched, that the children were still here, preserved like the bog boy, inside the walls. I could feel them peering at me through cracks and knotholes. I drifted into the next room. Weak light shone through a window. Petals of powder blue wallpaper drooped toward a couple of small beds, still clad in dusty sheets. I knew, somehow, that this had been my grandfather's room. "Why did you send me here? What was it you needed me to see?" Then I noticed something beneath one of the beds and knelt down to look. It was an old suitcase. "Was this yours? Is it what you carried onto the train the last time you saw your mother and father as your first life was slipping away?" I pulled it out and fumbled with its tattered leather straps. It opened easily, but except for a family of dead beetles, it was empty. I felt empty too, and strangely heavy, like the planet was spinning too fast, heating up gravity, pulling me toward the floor. Suddenly exhausted, I sat on the bed, his bed, maybe, and for reasons I can't quite explain, I stretched out on those filthy sheets and stared at the ceiling. "What did you think about lying here at night? Did you have nightmares too?" I began to cry. "When your parents died, did you know it? Could you feel them go?" I cried harder. I didn't want to, but I couldn't stop myself. I couldn't stop myself, so I thought about all the bad things and I fed it and fed it until I was crying so hard I had to gasp for breath between sobs. I thought about how my great-grandparents had starved to death. I thought about their wasted bodies being fed to incinerators because people they didn't know hated them. I thought about how the children who lived in this house had been burned up and blown apart because a pilot who didn't care pushed a button. I thought about how my grandfather's family had been taken from him, and how because of that my dad grew up feeling like he didn't have a dad. And now I had acute stress and nightmares and was sitting alone in a falling down house and crying hot, stupid tears all over my shirt. All because of a 70-year-old hurt that had somehow been passed down to me like some poisonous heirloom, and monsters I couldn't fight because they were all dead, beyond killing or punishing or any kind of reckoning. At least my grandfather had been able to join the army and go fight them. What could I do? When it was over, my head was pounding. I closed my eyes and pushed my knuckles in to stop them from hurting, if only for a moment, and when I finally released the pressure and opened them again, a miraculous change had come over the room. There was a single ray of sun shining through the window. I got up, went to the cracked glass, and saw that it was both raining and shining outside, a bit of meteorological weirdness whose name no one can seem to agree on. My mom, I kid you not, refers to it as orphan's tears. Then I remembered what Ricky says about it. The devil's beaten his wife. And I laughed and felt a little better. Then, in the patch of quickly fading sun that fell across the room, I noticed something I hadn't before. It was a trunk, or the edge of one at least, poking out from under the second bed. I went over and peeled back the bedsheet that hid most of it from view. It was a big, old steamer trunk latched with a giant rusting padlock. It couldn't possibly be empty, I thought. You don't lock an empty trunk. Open me, it fairly seemed to cry out. I am full of secrets. I grabbed it by the sides and pulled. It didn't move. I pulled again, harder, but it wouldn't give an inch. I wasn't sure if it was just that heavy, or if generations of accumulated moisture and dust had somehow fused it to the floor. I stood up and kicked it a few times, which seemed to jar things loose, and then I managed to move it by pulling on one side at a time, shimmying it forward the way you might move a stove or a fridge, until it had come out all the way from under the bed, leaving a trail of parenthetical scars in the floor. I yanked on the padlock, but despite a thick encrustation of rust, it seemed rock solid. I briefly considered searching for a key. It had to be here somewhere, but I could have wasted hours looking, and the lock was so decayed that I wondered if the key would even work anymore. My only option was to break it. Looking around for something that might do the job, I found a busted chair in one of the other rooms. I pried off a leg and went to town on the lock, raising the leg over my head like an executioner and bringing it down as hard as I could, over and over, until the leg itself finally broke and I was left holding a splintered stump. I scanned the room for something stronger and quickly spotted a loose railing on the bed frame. After a few stomping kicks, it clattered to the floor. I wedged one end through the lock and pulled the other end backward. Nothing happened. I hung on it with all my weight, lifting my feet off the floor like I was doing a pull-up with the rail. The trunk creaked a little, but that was it. I started to get mad. I kicked the trunk and pulled on that rail with every bit of my strength, the veins bulging out of my neck, yelling, "Open, goddamn you! Open, you stupid trunk!" Finally, my frustration and anger had an object. If I could make my dead grandfather give up his secrets, I would damn well pry the secrets out of this old trunk. And then the rail slipped, and I crashed to the floor and got the wind knocked out of me. I lay there and stared at the ceiling, catching my breath. The orphan's tears had ended, and now it was just plain old raining outside, harder than ever. I thought about going back to town for a sledgehammer or a hacksaw, but that would only raise questions I didn't feel like answering. Then I had a brilliant idea. If I could find a way to break the trunk, I wouldn't have to worry about the lock at all. And what force would be stronger than me and my admittedly underdeveloped upper body muscles wailing on the trunk with random tools? Gravity. I was, after all, on the second floor of the house, and while I didn't think there was any way I could lift the trunk high enough to get it through a window, the rail along the top of the staircase landing had long ago collapsed. All I had to do was drag the trunk down the hall and push it over. Whether its contents would survive the impact was another issue, but at least I'd find out what was inside. I hunkered down behind the trunk and began pushing it toward the hall. After a few inches, its metal feet dug into the soft floor and it ground stubbornly to a halt. Undeterred, I moved around to the other side, gripped the padlock with both hands, and pulled backward. To my great surprise, it moved 2 or 3 feet in one go. It wasn't a particularly dignified way of working, this squatting, butt-scooting motion I had to repeat over and over, each slide of the trunk accompanied by an ear-splitting metal-on-wood shriek. But before long, I'd gotten it out of the room and was dragging it, foot by foot, doorway by doorway, toward the landing. I lost myself in the echoing rhythm of it, working up a manly lather of sweat in the process. I finally made it to the landing and, with one final and delicate grunt, pulled the trunk onto it after me. It slid easily now, and after a few more shoves, I had it teetering precariously on the edge. One last nudge would be enough to send it over. But I wanted to see it shatter, my reward for all this work. So I got up and carefully shuffled toward the edge until I could glimpse the floor of the gloomy chamber below. Then, holding my breath, I gave the trunk a little tap with my foot. It hesitated for a moment, wobbling there on the edge of oblivion, and then pitched decisively forward and fell, tumbling end over end in beautiful balletic slow motion. There came a tremendous echoing crash that seemed to rattle the whole house as a plume of dust shot up at me from below, and I had to cover my face and retreat down the hall until it cleared. A minute later, I came back and peeked again over the landing and saw not the pile of smashed wood that I had so fondly hoped for, but a jagged trunk-shaped hole in the floorboards. It had fallen straight through into the basement. I raced downstairs and wriggled up to the edge of the buckled floor on my belly like you would a hole in thin ice. 15 feet below, through a haze of dust and darkness, I saw what remained of the trunk. It had shattered like a giant egg, its pieces all mixed up in a heap of debris and smashed floorboards. Scattered throughout were little pieces of paper. It looked like I'd found a box of letters after all. But then, squinting, I could make out shapes on them, faces, bodies, and that's when I realized they weren't letters at all, but photographs. Dozens of them. I got excited, and then, just as quickly, went cold, because something dreadful occurred to me. I have to go down there. The basement was a meandering complex of rooms so lightless, I may as well have explored them blindfolded. I descended the creaking stairs and stood at the bottom for a while, hoping my eyes would eventually adjust, but it was the kind of dark there was no adjusting to. I was hoping I'd get used to the smell, a strange, acrid stink like the supply closet in a chemistry classroom, but no such luck. So I shuffled in with my shirt collar pulled up over my nose and my hands held out in front of me, and hoped for the best. I tripped and nearly fell. Something made of glass went skidding away across the floor. The smell only seemed to get worse. I began to imagine things lurking in the dark ahead of me. Forget monsters and ghosts. What if there was another hole in the floor? They'd never find my body. Then I realized, in a minor stroke of genius, that by dialing up a menu screen on the cell phone I kept in my pocket, despite being 10 miles from the nearest bar of reception, I could make a weak flashlight. I held it out, aiming the screen away from me. It barely penetrated the darkness, so I pointed it at the floor. Cracked flagstone and mouse turds. I aimed it to the side. A faint gleam reflected back. I took a step closer and swept my phone around. Out of the darkness emerged a wall of shelves lined with glass jars. They were all shapes and sizes, mottled with dust and filled with gelatinous-looking things suspended in cloudy fluid. I thought of the kitchen and the exploded jars of fruits and vegetables I'd found there. Maybe the temperature was more stable down here, and that's why these had survived. But then I got closer still, and looked a little harder, and realized they weren't fruits and vegetables at all, but organs, brains, hearts, lungs, eyes, all pickled in some kind of home-brewed formaldehyde, which explained the terrific stench. I gagged and stumbled away from them into the dark, simultaneously grossed out and baffled. What kind of place was this? Those jars were something you might expect to find in the basement of a fly-by-night medical school, not a house full of children. If not for all the wonderful things Grandpa Portman had said about this place, I might have wondered if Miss Peregrine had rescued the children just to harvest their organs. When I'd recovered a little, I looked up to see another gleam ahead of me. Not a reflection of my phone, but a weak glimmer of daylight. It had to be coming from the hole I'd made. I soldiered on, breathing through my pulled-up shirt and keeping away from the walls and any other ghastly surprises they might have harbored. The gleam led me around a corner and into a small room with part of the ceiling caved in. Daylight streamed through the hole onto a mound of splintered floorboards and broken glass from which rose coils of silty dust, pieces of torn carpet plastered here and there like scraps of desiccated meat. Beneath the debris, I could hear the scrabble of tiny feet, some rodentine dark dweller that had survived the implosion of its world. In the midst of it all lay the demolished trunk, photographs scattered around it like confetti. I picked my way through the wreckage, high-stepping javelins of wood and plank studded with rusting nails. Kneeling, I began to salvage what I could from the pile. I felt like a rescue worker, plucking faces from the debris, brushing away glass and wood rot, and though part of me wanted to hurry, there was no telling if or when the rest of the floor might collapse on my head, I couldn't stop myself from studying them. At first glance, they looked like the kind of pictures you'd find in any old family album. There were shots of people cavorting on beaches and smiling on back porches, vistas from around the island, and lots of kids, posing in singles and pairs, informal snapshots and formal portraits taken in front of backdrops, their subjects clutching dead-eyed dolls like they'd gone to glamour shots in some creepy turn-of-the-century shopping mall. But what I found really creepy wasn't the zombie dolls or the children's weird haircuts or how they never, ever seemed to smile, but that the more I studied the pictures, the more familiar they began to seem. They shared a certain nightmarish quality with my grandfather's old photos, especially the ones he'd kept hidden in the bottom of his cigar box, as if somehow they'd all come from the same batch. There was, for instance, a photo of two young women posed before a not terribly convincing painted backdrop of the ocean. Not so strange in and of itself, the unsettling thing was how they were posed. Both had their backs to the camera. Why would you go to all the trouble and expense of having your picture taken? Portraits were pricey back then. And then turn your back on the camera. I half expected to find another photo in the debris of the same girls facing forward, revealing grinning skulls for faces. Other pictures seemed manipulated in much the same way as some of my grandfather's had been. One was of a lone girl in a cemetery staring into a reflecting pool, but two girls were reflected back. It reminded me of Grandpa Portman's photo of the girl trapped in a bottle, only whatever darkroom technique that had been used wasn't nearly as fake-looking. Another was of a disconcertingly calm young man whose upper body appeared to be swarming with bees. That would be easy enough to fake, right? like my grandfather's picture of the boy lifting what was certainly a boulder made of plaster. Fake rock, fake bees. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up as I remembered something Grandpa Portman had said about a boy he'd known here in the children's home. A boy with bees.